KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm a professor at Elon University School of Law and affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. And this year, a visiting research collaborator at Princeton Center for Information Technology Policy. Thank you for joining me today on the show. Today, I'm excited to have back on the show David Brin, author of The Transparent Society, which remains a classic in thinking about information flow and what we mean about transparency today and what we mean about how technology has infused our understanding of ourselves. But David is back on the show to discuss transparency, and particularly in its current context involving everything from Snowden to the negotiations of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. As I was preparing for this interview, I was looking back, and David was on the show on March 6th, 2007. Now, that was less than a year after I had started doing Hearsay Culture, and I was still physically present at Stanford University, where we discussed the Transparent Society in detail. It was also a time in the show before I left Stanford physically where I could play music as interludes between segments of the show because I was airing it live on KZSU and availing myself of the license agreement that KZSU has with licensing entities so they can play music. But of course, the nature of copyright law being what it is, I have to edit and would have to edit that music out of the podcast version of the show, where I think a majority of listeners do listen. And as a result of that and the function of time, I stopped playing music. But in going back in my show notes, when David was on in March 2007, I played the songs Doctor My Eyes by Jackson Browne, Stumbling Through the Dark by the Jayhawks, Dark Hollow by the Grateful Dead, and Bad Reputation by Freddie Johnston, which I think also tied directly into themes that we're going to re-explore today with 8 more years of human experience. So we're going to talk today about transparency, about some of David's recent writing, and he's a very active blogger at his blog at davidbrin.net. And we're going to talk about accountability and different aspects of law and legal regulation regarding information and what we know and what we don't know about both governments and corporations. This is a particularly timely interview as we're recording on September 28th, 2015, and there is a lot going on in this space. Most of my listeners will be familiar with David. I'm not going to do much more of an introduction except to say that I am thrilled to have him back on the show. And David, who is joining us via Skype from California, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Oh, terrific. Glad to be back. Stanford is one of my favorite haunts, though, of course, we're only there virtually.
Right.
One can hope virtuously as well.
That's right. And it is a wonderful place to have these kinds of discussions. And even though I'm now recording from the East Coast rather than the West Coast, I make it back as often as I can. David, as I mentioned in the introduction, many of my listeners are already familiar with you. But for those that may be less familiar, can you talk a bit more about your background and how you came to focus on transparency, broadly construed?
Well, my background has nothing to do with this. I was an electrical engineer with Hughes Aircraft. I mean Hughes Aircraft, old joke. I did my astrophysics undergraduate work at Caltech and got my PhD in astrophysics at UCSD. So I've been favored with a very broad and eclectic education. And along the way, I started writing novels that were far more successful than my science. I did some good science on comets and asteroids, and I'm still engaged in that work. I'm on NASA's Innovative and Advanced Concepts Group, for example, vetting new and advanced technologies that can get seed grants. And I'm involved in the search for extraterrestrial intelligence and some of the arguments going on there. But primarily, I'm best known as a science fiction author. So it would not have been a natural for one to add one more hat. But I got very upset with what I see is a mistake being made by society's best and brightest and smartest and most caring people. And these are the civil libertarians who genuinely and sincerely are afraid that we're going to have Big Brother. And they're right. They're completely right. I have an essay, if you look up my name and George Orwell, 1984, you'll find my essay where I talk about the self-preventing prophecy. And George Orwell's book, 1984, is probably the best example of this, which is the highest form of science fiction. And that's a prophecy that's so scary in pointing out a failure mode for humanity that prevents itself from coming true. And one could point to Soylent Green, which recruited millions of environmentalists to help prevent that from happening. I provided just about the earliest warning about global warming. One could point to all the World War III warning stories like Dr. Strangelove and On the Beach, which helped to prevent those dire things from happening. But Orwell's 1984 was the granddaddy of self-preventing prophecies because it recruited hundreds of millions of people to say, I am going to fight all my life to keep that from happening. Now, the difference is that everyone thinks they're the hero. So if you're to the left in American parlance, which means you're center right to Europeans, then you think Big Brother is going to come from conniving aristocrats and faceless corporations. If you're to the right, that portion of the right that's still sane these days, then you think that Big Brother is going to come from snooty academics and faceless government bureaucrats. And when you put it that way, the proper response is, well, duh, all of these are potential dangers. We're all right to some degree. The problem is we're so stoked on self-righteous indignation that we don't look underneath the self-righteousness. And to make a long story shorter than it was going to be, I got very, very worried that no one was pointing out an underlying process here that informs all of our arguments about freedom and privacy. And so I took a year off and wrote The Transparent Society. It won the Freedom of Speech Award of the American Library Association. My publishers want to do a 20th anniversary edition. Wired Magazine wants another cover from me. So it's had some influence. I do a lot of speaking on these issues, but it is so hard to get across the basic point. And the basic point is that we will not preserve freedom by hiding from elites. We will protect freedom by doing the thing that has gave us our freedom, and that's by using light to hold elites accountable.
And so this is this concept of reciprocal accountability that I want to talk about in a moment. Because, you know, when I had you back on the show in 2007, and I kind of want to, I'm not asking you to do a retrospective, but, you know, 2007 was, you know, before the economic collapse, although certainly those who were paying attention were beginning to predict it. You know, of course, you know, before the ubiquity of social media like it is today, and obviously before the revelations, not only from people like Snowden, but also Chelsea Manning and others, about the operations of government. You know, as you look back over, and we'll dig into some more recent observations that you've written about in a moment, but as you look back over the last 8 years and think about the nature of transparency, is there a thread or difference that you see today in this issue versus, say, 8 years ago?
Well, 8 years ago, we were still quivering and shaking from 9/11. I thought that we overreacted in many ways to that. Our parents and the Greatest Generation, they suffered that many casualties every month during World War II. But yes, we needed to take it seriously, and we needed to develop new techniques to deal with terrorism. What I pointed out in 1997 in The Transparent Society and back in 1989 in my novel Earth was that there's what's called a ratchet effect. And that is, no matter what limits you put on the power of the state to look, those limits will be eliminated the next time there's a panic. Just as many limits on the FBI were eliminated after 9/11. And that's called the ratchet effect. So if you may make a law that says the NSA cannot look. As a matter of fact, in 2007, we had just recently, in 2004, had a great big civil liberties victory when it was discovered that John Poindexter and DARPA were developing something called Total Information Awareness, or TIA. And I believe we discussed this at the time. Mm-hmm. And rules were passed, laws were passed to ban this. And DARPA's information systems budget was zeroed out, and it was killed. And lo and behold, we now know, Snowden showed us, that TIA just went away and hid in the NSA. If you ban the NSA from using new methods to look, what do you think is going to happen? Have you ever been to an arcade and played the game Whack-A-Mole? Right. You know, you get this great big mallet, and a mole sticks up its head. You whack it. Another one sticks up its head. And each time you discover that they've been looking at us, and you whack them down, the next time it'll be harder to find them because they'll get better at it. And the next time we have a panic because something bad happened, like 9/11, the laws will be changed to make it easier for them. This is not a winning proposition. Trying to limit what our watchdogs can see, what that does is it sets us up for this insane dichotomy that all of our civil liberties heroes buy into. They all buy into it. And that is the notion that there is a dichotomy, a trade-off, a zero sum between safety and freedom. Everybody misquotes Benjamin Franklin. Those who would trade a little liberty for some safety wind up getting neither. Well, Ben was a very wise guy, and he'd be infuriated with the notion of a zero-sum game. And I can prove that there is no such zero-sum trade-off between security, safety, and freedom. And the disproof of that is us. In all of human history, no people have ever been so safe. And in all of human history, no people have ever been so free. The two go together. It's a positive sum game. And those out there who preach zero-sum games are preaching an insanity that is betrayal of everything about our experiment. Our experiment is the positive sum game experiment. And if you don't know the concept of the positive sum game, then you're not qualified to be a citizen in this era. I mean that. Hmm. Go home, study, and understand the difference between positive sum games and zero sum games. It is the most important concept. And if you understand a positive sum game, then you realize that there are times when you can have your cake and eat it too and watch it grow while aggressively sharing it. That has been the story of the West. That's been the story of America. So how could we have our cake and eat it too regarding secrecy, regarding security, safety, privacy, freedom? It turns out we have been. Throughout the last several generations, here's a perfect example. The year 2013 was the best year for civil liberties in the United States in three decades, yet the press never mentioned it. Why? What happened in 2013 was that the Obama administration and the courts together ruled that there is an absolute settled law, an absolute right of citizens who are not interfering with the police to record the police. It's absolute. Mm-hmm. And so all of the attempts that the police were making in 2012 and before to make it illegal and confiscate all the phones, suddenly that became illegal. And we're seeing the effects on the streets as the poor and minorities and average folks now have a fundamental recourse on the streets if their rights are violated. And that recourse is the truth. They can record. And now, is it happening perfectly? Of course not. If you look on page 160 of the Transparent Society, you'll see a creepy prediction of exactly this situation. And there are cops who are accidentally breaking the cameras of people now. But at the end of 2013, the same year, we got to see the image of a man in an orange jumpsuit being sentenced to a couple years in prison for lying about having deliberately smashed the camera of the man he was arresting. Now that's a change. And because it's a change for the better, nobody's paying any attention to it at all. But cameras are becoming the great equalizer on the street, the way the Colt 45 was supposedly in the Old West. It's happening now. It's happening in real time. And it's not important that I predicted it in the Transparent Society and in Earth. What's important is that we are doing it now, and it's happening now because a technology that could empower Big Brother is being embraced instead by people.
Let me pause, and we're chatting with David Brin on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. David, let me posit a theory that might help explain why, as you point out, fewer people seem to recognize these positive developments. And tell me what you think, because as you were talking this through, and as I was thinking about this interview, and I was reminded of the constant or increasingly prominent refrain about cyber utopianism, right? The idea that the first generation, if you will, of the modern internet thinkers were utopian theorists along the lines of people like Lewis Mumford, who saw technology as solving all problems, and then we have some of the events that I mentioned, including as you mentioned, 9/11, which to that line of thinking burst that bubble, right? And so modern commentators on technology like Evgeny Marzov and Mark Barreline and others have pointed out, look, see, this shows, and I'm simplifying a bit, right? But this shows that technology really isn't a panacea, but that in fact it creates, and I'm paraphrasing even more here, more problems than it solves. Do you think that, and I'm asking for your reaction to this, do you think that that bursting of the cyber utopian bubble might in part explain why we now fail to recognize when positive developments are happening because of technology?
Well, Peter Diamandis, who wrote one of the most important recent books called Abundance, he is, of course, a cloud cuckoo optimist, but he makes very powerful arguments showing just how many things are getting better, and certainly not all things. But one of the things he points out is that we are genetically predisposed to be grouches and to notice the downsides, because that's evolutionarily advantageous. If you're an Australopithecus going across the savanna and you hear a rustling in the high grass, it could be a bird you could go chase down, or it could be a lion stalking you. Your imagination is going to be filled with lions because you're descended from the ones who lived because they did that. If you go back across the last 400, 500 years to when we developed glass lenses, movable type printing presses, perspective, these changed what we were able to see, what we were able to know, what we were able to perceive and pay attention to and reach. And at the beginning, grouches always, and then a generation later, you got libraries and you got telescopes. A generation later, you got so on and so on and so on. Every generation has been challenged by augmentations of what we can see, know, perceive, and reach. And always grouches said, this information flow, this fire hose, is more than a person, especially an average person, can withstand. God didn't make us to, or evolution didn't make us to be able to handle this, and it's going to cause problems. And always there were transcendentalists and optimists who said, this is going to make us better. And always the grouches were right first. movable type printing presses did not at first make us wiser. They spread religious tracts, which exacerbated the horrible wars of the Reformation in Europe. Only later, when there were enough printing presses, did books spread and people started to get the notion that this is going to help me to experience life being another person, maybe a person different than me, maybe a person who lives somewhere far away. And radio and newsreels started to get us empathy for people in China during the Japanese invasion. And television gave us empathy for people starving overseas. And now we see the pain, despite the fact that in another very important book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, and that is an absolutely essential book that people must get their hands on. It proves that per capita, the rates of violence worldwide have never been lower, and the rates of poverty are plummeting, with more and more children coming home to apartments that have a refrigerator, clean water, and electricity that they can study by. Despite all those good things, because we are so connected in the world, we notice the bad things more. And here I'm going to surprise you, because I'm going to say that's as it should be. Mm-hmm. The only way we can get better is by self-flagellating, by being self-critical, by noticing the bad more than we notice the good. But it is not sane to completely and compulsively ignore the good, especially when the good news outnumbers the bad news by so much. And that is the part that I find myself having to point to. The fact that, you know, I'm not an optimist, I'm a contrarian. And when everyone around me is a pessimist, that forces me to be an optimist.
David Mamet wrote in Glengarry Glen Ross, you know, if everyone says one thing, I say bet the other way. And perhaps that's where you're going with this. So I do want to ask you, though, I just want to make sure that I understand your answer. So are the utopians, if we put them in a group, still out there but are getting drowned out? Or because you started with a reference to a quasi-utopian theorists, but are these voices that are voices that are heard today? Are they valued today? Because this is, you know, this at its core, it seems to me, is a major problem that and challenge that we have in thinking through, which I want to talk about after our break, the role of technology today and this concept of reciprocal accountability that you've written about. So where are those, what's the place for the cyber-utopian today, if there is one?
Oh, there are plenty of them. You hear about the singularity, for instance. Ray Kurzweil talks about how the singularity is near, and he poo-poos the negative singularity of, you know, AI stomping us flat or that sort of thing, which is what Hollywood always warns us about because it's more interesting to have a fun film if the AI is nasty.
Right.
And people can look up my name, David Brenn, and Idiot Plot, and see an essay that'll open their eyes to why we get so many dystopias and why we're getting so many apocalypses, boring apocalypses. But, you know, I mentioned Peter Diamandis' book Abundance Pinker's book The Better Angels of Our Nature. There are lots of people out there pointing out the good news. And the evidence is overwhelmingly in their favor. But as when I point out the great equalizer effect of the cameras in our cell phones spreading freedom to the streets, people have an aversion to looking at that. The news media does not benefit from telling good news. They benefit from sensationalism. And above all, those evil, corrupt news media that have taken over the political extremes in America. And I'll be honest with you, I think it's the far left and the entire right. It is not in their interest to notice good news because wrath and sanctimony and indignation and anger and fear are addictive. They make us feel good. they fill our bodies with endorphins and enkephalins and dopamine. Self-righteous indignation. Well, hell, look up David Brin and self-righteousness. For one thing, I guess I qualify. But the other thing is that if you have a sense of humor about it, supposedly it gives you a pass.
Right.
But also I have some amusing YouTubes about that. But that's why we pay more attention to the bad news than the good. And as I said, if you had to choose between paying only attention to bad news and only paying attention to good news, I'd rather sit with the cynics and the pessimists, because at least they see problems to be solved. Whereas cloud cuckoo optimists bore me and they're not solving problems. But that's not the situation. There is only one group in America today that still looks at problems not as things to moan about, but as things that can be solved by technology, by goodwill, by law, by applications of market ingenuity and government. This is the way our parents in the greatest generation thought. They would mix these things. They would pragmatically compromise and negotiate. There's only one group in American life that still does this, and it's not the far left, and it's not the entire right. It's classic liberals. Mm-hmm. They're the only ones left who are willing to admit, yeah, there's some good news that we could build on in order to solve the bad stuff.
We're chatting with David Brin, author of The Transparent Society, a very active blogger, writer, science fiction author on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to KZSU regularly, you know that it is a non-profit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways to make a donation to KZSU. You could email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or you can go to our webpage and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I hope that you continue to listen to the show. So, you know, David, we're recording on September 28th, 2015. Two stories, I think, relevant to what you're saying, and I feel compelled to ask you about them in light of what you just pointed out about the theoretical and political spectrum and where the bridge building / solutions folks are. And those two big stories are the continuing breaking news regarding Volkswagen and their efforts to write code to thwart, apparently very effectively until researchers found out about it, U.S. Clean air provisions. And the second is the resignation of John Boehner. Now, I don't do lots of pure politics on Hearsay Culture, but I think it's relevant here. And I want to ask you about, in light of what you just said, about Boehner first, and then kind of work backwards to Volkswagen and getting to this concept of reciprocal accountability, which you mentioned at the beginning, and we should discuss. So, you know, here we have again a situation where on the current political spectrum, Boehner now appears far more pragmatic and even center, if you will, than he would have appeared 15 or 20 years ago. And Boehner had come to power by being among the most conservative members and is now being outflanked by those who, as you pointed out at the beginning, right, are moving even further to the right. You know, if we think about our prospects in the short term for addressing the many challenges that people have identified as potentially solved by technology, it sure seems like right now, at least in the United States at the national level, that polarization is only deepening. You know, from this perspective of pragmatic solution building, what do you make of Boehner's rather sudden resignation and prospects for being able to think through the policy challenges that you mentioned and build upon that good news?
Well, first off, I don't think right and left really are relevant anymore.
Okay.
When business always does better across Democratic administrations than Republican administrations. And I mean always. when the outcomes for economic outcomes are always better across Democratic administrations than they are across the span of Republican administrations. When we get vastly more innovation and more small business startups and more venture startups across Democratic administrations than across Republican ones, what does right mean except the old original meaning of favoring a lordly aristocratic class? And the context we have to put this in is 6,000 years of human history, in which nearly all places where we had agriculture, at least, developed feudal social systems, with a few at the top lording it over masses below, and a few priests saying, this is good, this is good, this is good. It's good that this lord, this king, is going to owns you and owns your daughters, and his son will inherit them. And that was the standard human social pattern for 6,000 years. Pericles' Athens rebelled against it for a couple generations. There were a couple of other glimmers, but basically we're in the revolution. This is a 230-year-old revolution. And we need to look at it as a radical revolution. And it has nothing to do with communism or socialism. Back in the 1950s and 60s, the greatest anti-communist force in the world was the AFL-CIO, was the American Labor Movement. And there are reasons for that. The Republicans wanted to go isolationist. So it's not classic left versus right. I've been puzzled by this whole thing, and I've come to realize what it is, I believe. And that is that the Republican Party is now, for all intents and purposes, the Confederacy. It's reborn, and it's not the first time it's happened. There have been eight phases to the American Civil War, and this one, they know better than to leave the tent. They're destroying the United States from within the tent. And I think that Americans, urban, educated Americans, are coming to realize that this is not their father's or their grandfather's Republican Party anymore. And I think Boehner has finally realized it. The irony being, of course, that Boehner joined with Tom DeLay and Dennis Hastert back in 1996-7 to punish and exile Newt Gingrich for the crime of having negotiated with Bill Clinton during the miracle year, the only year that a Republican Congress ever negotiated with a Democratic president was 1995, when Gingrich paused in his highly partisan hounding of Clinton in order to negotiate with him. And the result was the Anna Mirabilis of 1995, when we got both welfare reform and the Budget Act. And the result being 4 years in which we were paying down our debt. And Hastert publicly declared, this will never happen again. And there's something called the Hastert rule. And Boehner was a member of that coterie that ejected Newt Gingrich, who, by the way, is a science fiction author. And while I think he's about 60% crazy, there's a good 20-30% of Newt Gingrich that I miss terribly. I mean, his kind of Republican, at least you could negotiate with every now and then. I didn't mean to get all this partisan, but, you know, when we face a situation in which a critical core portion of a political party's agenda is hatred not only of scientists, but of all educated and skilled castes in society, all teachers, economists, law professionals, medical doctors, all of them, when you have a political party that has declared war on all of the people who know stuff.
And it is hard to, you know, it's hard to argue with certainly the notion that there is a capture of the process of getting people into office. that's allowed for these fringe voices to have far more power than they might have otherwise, which gets us actually back in the direction of questions about technology. Something you've written recently about paths to access information, and I'll quote you from a recent blog post. You wrote, "Modems gave way to internet service providers, but when those came under state control, it became incumbent upon us to widen the field again. New satellite systems," you've written, "may give people all over the world access points their own governments cannot control. We need to make this a matter of top concern right now and not let that opportunity be squelched." What exactly is the opportunity there that you see us potentially missing, and how perhaps can that opportunity, if properly exploited, get at these issues of division and inability to address complex problems that you're identifying today?
Well, I'd like to take us back to around 1990, when before Senator Al Gore became vice president, and some members of his staff drew up a bill that he asked for. And that bill was something that nobody in their right minds would ever expect powerful men to do. Because even at that point, it was clear that the internet was a spectacular tool of power. And what Gore's bill did was it unleashed the internet. It basically said, fly, go away, off to the world you go. Everyone on the planet can use the internet for free, with only the tiniest sliver of regulation from the United States Department of Commerce. And it's mind-boggling to imagine that they did that, because it was the greatest jujitsu move I have ever seen a civilization perform. And I'm saying the civilization of the West, the civilization of the revolution against feudalism. Because what it did was it created the subsequent 25 years of the internet serving as despots' worst nightmare, the worst nightmare to tyrants. And it's been a terrible time for tyrants, because their people were online and could get the truth. The problem is that over time, tyrants learn how, bad people learn how to take advantage of the last generation's solution to the problem. And now there are nations all over the world, and they are trading information with each other, because this is a high priority for and some of these nations control a third of the world's people. And it's been a high priority among them to share resources and to develop techniques to turn the internet into a means of control over their population, instead of their population being free from control. And they think they have it sussed now. They think they have it down. But if Google and Microsoft and all these other companies go ahead and launch these systems of 100 satellites and all these balloons that Google's developing, that can give it internet access to anybody with Wi-Fi, then that would be an end run around their techniques that they've developed to keep their people in the dark. Because the thing about a revolution is you have to keep it active. And the saddest thing today is that those people who most remember that this is a revolution, this is a militant, one-chance-only revolution. Because if we get feudalism back, if the Rupert Murdochs of the world and their Saudi partners who co-own Fox News, and there are people who feel this way on the far left as well, if they have their way, then we'll go back to a pyramidal social structure like feudalism. And they will never let democracy and positive-sum game systems and open systems and transparent systems ever be tried again. They'll know. So this is our one chance. And if we're going to keep this revolution going, it means every generation is going to have to refresh the revolution. Because every generation, the last set of tools, clever people learn how to manipulate them for their own benefit. So we have to keep innovating until we get Star Trek, when everybody is raised to be grown up in school, and they get out of school grown up enough to recognize that a free and open positive sum system is in their own interests. See, I take a big picture. I go back across 6,000 years, and I look ahead in time as well. And we need to do that more. And, of course, that's what you get if you read my books.
Yes. Well, that's – and I did want to ask you this, and you mentioned it now, and I wanted to get at this. This is kind of a little bit more of a tradecraft question. But you blog on a wide variety of topics, and I'm curious how you go about picking your topics. What is it? Because you blog very regularly, and I commend my listeners to read your blog because of the range of information and the insights. But how do you pick your topics from day to day? Is there a thread that you're trying to follow at least today that allows you to opine on everything from the TPP right to the question of what modems are doing?
Well, I am so thrilled to live in this time, to be part of a culture that has allowed me to escape the bonds that I would have been in the old Europe, that crushed my grandparents and made them move here. It's not just a matter of business opportunities. It's the fact that, I went to university in California, and there is a, what probably the one YouTube I recommend that people of mine, that people get their college students or their high school seniors to watch, is where I give advice to new people who are heading off to college. And you can link to it on your site. And it says that if you just take classes in college and party, you're betraying your civilization. What you should do at least once a month is go from door to door, just pick random doors in random buildings at the university campus, a different building every once a month, and knock on the door and say, "What do you do here?" And if they kick you out, you knock on the next door. And I did that. And as a result, I got the perfect education for a science fiction author, because I know a little bit about everything, because I know so many people in so many different walks of life. And if you let your own curiosity be killed, instead of looking at what's going on around you as being a spectacular Disney ride, this last year was the best year for human exploration of space ever, mm-hmm. and I'm including the moon landings.
Yeah, well, just today we're told the NASA announced that they do think flowing water on Pluto happens from time. Excuse me, Mars happens from time to time.
It goes on and on and on. It's been every other week.
Yeah,
and the fraction of our fellow citizens who are jazzed over the $5 that they spent this year on NASA, there is a point where not paying attention to how spectacularly lucky you are, and not just to be free, which is the Bush Fox thing. It becomes a mantra then. But to give examples of the stuff my people are doing, this, my civilization is doing this. And right now, the United States of America is absorbing half of the world's immigrants, and we're doing a good job of it. We're making most of them into good citizens and members of our revolution. What people could possibly do that? We are a mighty folk, a folk of legend. And if we succeed in saving this world from the idiots who want us to ignore simple problems we can solve, like climate change, if we can save this world and make a better education system so our children keep getting better than us. And this latest crop of children is better than the boomers already. If we can do that, what do you think the Star Trek people will think of us? Who will be their heroes? They will know with computer models better than we do how tough this job was. And if we succeed, if we squeak through, if we make a Star Trek world of justice and opportunity and brilliance and diversity and courage, if we make that civilization, there'll be statues to all of us who helped. They'll set robots to work on the moon. It'll be covered with a couple hundred million statues if you did something to help.
You know, David, I'm tempted to close the show there with a note of wonderful, optimism makes it sound like it isn't born in fact, but really I think a very clear-eyed view of what our potential is. However, we still have about 5 or 6 minutes left, but I want to build on that perspective because I do agree with you that we don't hear about it enough, even to the extent that people get their news through the various tunnels and vacuums of how information is aggregated. And so let me ask you this, to build on this point, right? I said I would come back to this concept of reciprocal accountability, which you have written about extensively. You've written, cowering and hiding from elites has never worked and cannot work, right? Let's talk for a moment in the last, and we have about 6 minutes or so, how reciprocal accountability, in your view, can be a solution not just to, as you point out, or as I pointed out, the negative issues like the Volkswagen situation, but also the positive aspects of how we can have a better understanding of what our society is doing to allow us to build upon the strengths that you mentioned, which don't get a lot of attention. What is the role for reciprocal accountability in 2015?
Well, the problem that we face between the left and the right is actually very simple. Most of our positive sum gains in our civilization have come about through harnessing reciprocal accountability arenas. And these five biggest arenas are democracy, science, courts, markets, and sports. And in all of these, we harness the greatest creative force of the universe, and that's competition. And that makes me sound like a right winger, because the left has been tutored to think the word competition is evil. And that's insane. We're competitive creatures. Our greatest creativity comes out of competition, and leftists who are trying to push their point of view are competing. No. They are crazy to decry competition, but the right is crazier, because the right says competition works automatically without regulation. And you look across the last 6,000 years, and competitive systems have always been destroyed, and turned into rigid, feudal pyramids by cheaters. And that's what happens. Winners who have a little influence and power don't try to compete next time. They try to get around competition by cheating. Look at what would happen in sports, the fifth arena, if you got rid of the regulation. All the best athletes would group together on one team. And if you had no regulation, they would physically kill the members of the other teams to eliminate the competition. And they would thus destroy the productivity of the sports arena. The whole purpose of sports is to give us two things. One, lots of thrilling, close entertainment, close competitions, and money for the owners of the sports teams and the athletes. And it does both. And it does both because it's regulated. markets deliver us goods and services when they're heavily regulated, and when they get taken over by monopolists or duopolists or cheaters, they get ruined, and that's happening now. Democracy gives us better policy when it's competition with negotiation and compromise, and that's being killed. Science is being waged war upon because science is the most competitive of all these fields and delivers us truth, and the cheaters in all the other fields can't afford to let that stand. So what I'm saying is reciprocal accountability is more than just about being able to snap pictures of a policeman doing something bad. It's more than just putting assurances in so that we can keep an eye on, you know, the NSA and the FBI while letting them look for bad guys in a positive-sum game. It's more than all of that. Reciprocal accountability is how we made our revolution. It's by learning how to joyfully compete with each other without killing each other. And in order to do that, competition has to be regulated and then re-regulated and then re-regulated. It's a constant, ongoing dynamic. And this is what the far left and the entire right now hates. And this is what we have to insist that we reinvigorate, we re-regulate and rejigger the regulations for markets and for democracy and make them work competitively again.
David Brin, author of The Transparent Society, active blogger. You mentioned a number of your works, both writing as well as video. For those that want to learn more, where other than YouTube, where would you point them?
Well, I have a site called davidbrin.com, all one word, and it's filled with stuff, as you might imagine, links to podcasts. You want to find out more about that whole self-righteousness thing? I have one that was extremely popular on TED. And, of course, I have my novels, and that helps pay for having three kids in college at the same time. And that stuff's the good stuff. That's the good stuff. Though there is the Transparent Society, and, you know, I'm about to give speeches in New York, D.C., Amsterdam, Seattle. So it's a lot of public speaking as well.
Let me ask you this, David. We do have one more minute. I can't resist. So I have two young sons. They are 6 and 8 years old. You gave an impassioned talk about what our potential is. If you had a 6 and an 8-year-old boy in front of you and you had a decent attention span, but let's truncate it to 60 seconds, what do you tell them about where we are now?
I inoculate them against the sects that surround them everywhere, including their peers, and tell them that it's all right to be excited. The cynics curl their lip, and they can sneer, and they can win any argument by sneering. But don't let them. Anyone who sneers at you being excited about space or about being something or doing something or about the time that you live in, that person is weak. And the sneer is a whimper of weakness. And you can be armed. You can go out there and you can be a person who finds everything interesting. Everything.
David, I will paraphrase, if not quote directly, to my sons. David Brin, thank you so much for coming back on the show after amazingly over 8 years. I want to have you back again before another 8 years have passed, but I do appreciate you taking the time today to share your perspectives on where we are today, and thank you for taking the time.
Good luck to us all. Go out there and be ornery and contrarian. Be critical, not pessimistic, around all the fizzy optimists, and be optimists around the cynics. It'll drive them nuts.
Like I said, Mamet said it best. Thank you, David, so much. We're in show two of the fall quarter on KZSFM schedule. A lot of great guests are coming up this quarter, including and not the entire list. In fact, Sam Brailowski of the Library of Congress's National Sound Preservation Board, editor of the ARSC Guide to Audio Preservation, Ryan Kahle of the University of Washington on Robotics Regulation and Law. Also, a number of guests focusing on these issues involving surveillance and secrecy and transparency, including Mariette Shaka, member of the European Parliament and active on democracy and technology in Europe, and several other guests that I am in the process of finalizing right now. As you know, Hearsay Culture is on KZSU. I'm recording the show right before I know when the show airs this quarter. But you can always get the show by listening to KZSU or by getting it via podcast by going to the iTunes page for the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford. We can also get all the previous speakers and upcoming speakers. You can go to hearsayculture.com where you can get all 245 previous shows, or you can go to the webpage for the Center for Internet Society at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback by either going to the contact link at hearsayculture.com or by emailing me at dave@hearsayculture.com. I mentioned this last week. I'm going to mention it again. To the extent that you know anyone or you yourself might be interested in interning or externing with Hearsay Culture, I need some assistance really operating on the back end of the website, and I've been very fortunate to have Brandon Fry, a former iMedia student at Elon, as well as his advisor, William Munner, who oversaw the redesign of Hearsay Culture's website earlier this year. And so I'm doubling down on the hope that there might be someone out there who wants to help out. And if you are interested in helping out, again, go to the contact link or email me at dave@hearsayculture.com. Thank you much for joining me today on the show. I hope you found it educational, enlightening, and in this case, really uplifting. And I look forward to chatting with you next week. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.